He was born in the hills of Jamaica, raised in the heart of a concrete jungle, and rose to become the voice of the voiceless. Bob Marley didn't just make music. He sparked revolutions, calmed civil wars, and preached unity to a world divided. From the ghettos of Kingston to the battlefields of apartheid South Africa, his songs became weapons of peace, prayers of resistance, and anthems of freedom. This is not just the story of a man. It's the story of a global awakening, told through rhythm, rebellion, and redemption. The gospel, according to Bob Marley, still sings. And the echo? It never ends. Welcome to the History of the Caribbeans podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Bob Marley, A Journey Through Time, Episode 2. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 5, Burning and Breakthrough. There comes a point in every revolution when the fire can no longer be contained, when whispers become roars, and the hunger for change grows louder than the fear of consequence. For Bob Marley and the Wailers, that moment came in the early 1970s, a time of upheaval, clarity, and ignition. This was the season of burning, not just metaphorically, but spiritually, politically, and musically. The world was about to listen. But before it did, Jamaica would catch fire first. In the quiet corners of the island, the pressure had been building for years. Politicians clashed like titans, each claiming to stand for the poor, while the streets bore the brunt of their battles. Michael Manley's democratic socialism clashed with Edward Seega's capitalism, and the neighborhoods, Trenchtown, Tivoli Gardens, Arnett Gardens, became battlegrounds. Guns flowed into the garrisons. Party loyalty wasn't a choice anymore. It was survival. Gang warfare, disguised as politics, took over the inner cities. Bullets became ballots. And the music? The music became the only honest voice left. It was in this storm of corruption and chaos that Bob Marley and the Wailers began to sharpen their blade. By 1972, Bob had grown increasingly dissatisfied with the limits of the Jamaican music industry. Studio One had been their training ground. Wail and Solem had given them independence. But what Bob wanted now was impact, global reach, true ownership, and the ability to elevate reggae to its rightful place as a language of resistance. He took a bold step. He reached out to Chris Blackwell, a white Jamaican-born businessman who had founded Island Records in London. Blackwell, savvy and fearless, had already been distributing Jamaican music in the UK, but was looking for an act that could break reggae into the mainstream. He saw something in Bob Marley, something raw, revolutionary, magnetic. But more than that, he saw something that could translate beyond Jamaica's borders. Bob wasn't just a singer. He was a movement wrapped in melody. Blackwell offered the Wailers an advance, reportedly £4,000, a modest sum, but more than they'd ever seen at once. It was enough to fund their recording sessions for what would become the most important albums of their early career. But there was tension. Bunny and Peter were skeptical of Blackwell, a white man now steering their revolutionary message. They feared exploitation, dilution, control. Bob, however, understood something deeper. He wasn't interested in submission. He saw Blackwell not as a savior, but as a strategic channel, a platform to spread fire, not to water it down. So the Wailers went into the studio and began to sculpt what would become Catch a Fire, released in 1973, a landmark album, both sonically and spiritually. The production was slicker, more accessible. Blackwell added overdubs, guitar solos, keyboard flourishes to make the sound more palatable to rock audiences. But at its core, the music remained fierce, rooted, unflinching. Slave Driver, Concrete Jungle, and No More Trouble weren't just songs. They were sonic sermons, stories of struggle turned into weapons of sound. Slave Driver, the table is turned slash Catch a Fire, you're gonna get burned, wasn't metaphor. It was prophecy. The album cover alone was iconic. A Zippo lighter flipped open, flame rising. Symbolism soaked into cellophane. Marley had lit the match. The world was watching the spark. That same year, the band toured the UK and America, playing small venues, often to audiences who didn't yet understand reggae's rhythm but were entranced by its spiritual gravity. Bob's presence on stage was otherworldly. He moved like a man possessed, not performing for applause, but preaching with rhythm. His dreadlocks whipped like live wires. His eyes blazed with intent. Every song was a declaration, every verse a warning. But behind the scenes, things weren't holding together. Bunny Wailer, deeply spiritual and weary of the touring lifestyle, especially in countries that didn't understand Rastafari, began to pull back. He preferred the hills of Jamaica, the solitude of reasoning, the presence of his faith. He didn't like the smoky bars, the unfamiliar foods, the stage lights that made him feel like a curiosity. For Bunny, the music was sacred. The tour circuit, to him, felt like prostitution of the message. Peter Tosh, on the other hand, was the firebrand. He saw himself as a warrior, an unfiltered voice of the people. He clashed openly with management, journalists, and law enforcement. He was brilliant, passionate, but uncompromising. And in a system still deeply racist and suspicious of Rasta culture, Peter's directness was often misread as aggression. He didn't tone down his message, he turned it up. But in doing so, he began to move on a different frequency than Bob. By the time the Wailers returned to Jamaica to begin work on their next album, the cracks were too wide to ignore. Still, they gathered once more in the studio and delivered one last masterpiece as a trio, Burnin', released in 1973. This album was not just a follow-up. It was a warning shot, a manifesto. It was the sound of a people fed up, standing tall, and daring Babylon to strike. Get Up, Stand Up became an anthem, not just in Jamaica, but globally. Written by Bob and Peter, the song was a rallying cry, not for polite protest, but for spiritual resistance. Get up, stand up slash stand up for your right slash don't give up the fight, simple words, but carved with the precision of gospel and the threat of rebellion. I Shot the Sheriff was another standout, its story layered in metaphor. Bob insisted the sheriff was not a literal lawman, but a symbol of oppression, a metaphor for those who criminalize freedom. When Eric Clapton covered the song in 1974, it shot to number one on the U.S. charts, introducing Marley's message to millions who had never heard of him. The irony wasn't lost on Bob. The same system that ignored his voice now celebrated it, filtered through a white artist's cover. That's when Bob knew. He had to take the message directly to the people himself. Shortly after Burnin', both Peter Tosh and Bunny Wailer officially left the group. It was a painful separation. Brothers who had walked through fire together now taking different paths. There was no betrayal, only evolution. Each man had his mission. Bob respected it. But the moment was pivotal. From that point on, the band would no longer be the Wailers, plural. It would be Bob Marley and the Wailers. A new configuration. A new direction. Same route, new branches. Bob reassembled the band with new players, including Aston Family Man Barrett on bass and Carlton Barrett on drums, the heartbeat of reggae. The rhythms became tighter. The messages even sharper. And soon, three powerful female voices would join the soundscape. The I3s, featuring Rita Marley, Judy Mowat, and Marcia Griffiths. Their harmonies added a celestial layer to Bob's earthbound truths. The fire was burning higher now. No longer local. No longer ignored. The breakthrough had come. But so had the burden. For Bob Marley, there was no turning back. He had walked through the smoke, risen through the betrayal, and stood at the edge of a platform few Jamaican artists had ever reached. The world was now listening, and he would not waste a single breath. The revolution had a rhythm. The voice of the oppressed had found its messenger. And the fire? The fire was just getting started. Chapter 6. Exodus to the World. There comes a point in every prophet's journey when home no longer feels safe. When the ground beneath the feet begins to quake, not from doubt, but from danger. When the very people one sings for become split in their allegiances, and the voice of truth becomes a threat to those in power. For Bob Marley, that moment came on the night of December 3, 1976, in Kingston, Jamaica. The house at 56, Hope Road, was meant to be a sanctuary, a place of music, prayer, and community. It was where Bob rehearsed with the Wailers, meditated with Rasta elders, played football with neighborhood youths, and reasoned into the early morning hours. But on that night, As Marley and his circle prepared for the upcoming Smile Jamaica concert, gunmen stormed the premises, spraying bullets through doors and windows. The attack was swift and chaotic. Rita Marley shot in the head. Don Taylor, Bob's manager, critically wounded. Bob himself grazed by bullets in his chest and arm. The would-be assassins fled into the dark, their identities never publicly confirmed. Though speculation would point in every direction, political operatives, gang affiliations, CIA involvement, whispers of a global system rattled by Marley's growing influence. The motive was clear enough: intimidation. Marley had become too powerful, too unifying. He was scheduled to headline a free concert, Smile Jamaica, organized with the government's backing, just 2 days before the 1976 general election. Though Bob insisted he had no partisan allegiance, his presence alone was interpreted as political endorsement, a threat to whichever side feared losing ground. His neutrality, in a nation torn by violence, was seen as provocation. But the bullets did not silence him. Against all advice, Bob performed at the concert, just 48 hours after the assassination attempt. He walked on stage, bandaged and bruised, lifted his guitar like a torch, and played not out of defiance, but from a deep, burning duty. When asked why he went on, he answered plainly, "The people who are trying to make this world worse are not taking a day off. How can I?" But Marley knew the threat was real. That night confirmed what he had long sensed. Jamaica could no longer hold him. Not because he loved it less, but because his message had outgrown its borders. And so soon after the concert, Bob, Rita, and his children quietly left the island, first for Nassau, and then on to London, where he would begin the most important chapter of his international journey. It was exile, but it was also exodus. London in 1977 was a world apart. Cold skies, heavy fog, punk music on the rise. Immigrants from the Caribbean, India, and Africa clashed with police in the streets, while working-class neighborhoods simmered with racial tension. Yet amidst the grayness, Bob found a strange sort of clarity. He wasn't home, but he was heard. In England, Marley was both a symbol of exotic, mystique, and radical authenticity. He was embraced by skinheads, students, black nationalists, and leftist intellectuals alike. With a wounded body and an awakened spirit, Bob threw himself into work. In a rented house on Oakley Street in Chelsea, he began recording what would become his magnum opus, the album Exodus. The title alone carried layers, political, biblical, personal. Just as the Israelites had fled Pharaoh's tyranny in search of the promised land, Bob too was moving through a spiritual and physical escape, leading not just himself, but a generation of wanderers searching for justice, identity, and liberation. The album was unlike anything he had done before. It was smoother, heavier, slower, soaked in Rasta philosophy, but refined for a global ear. The band, now featuring the rock-solid rhythms of Aston family man Barrett and the ethereal harmonies of the i3s, had found a perfect balance between earth and sky. Side A of Exodus pulsed with urgency and rebellion. The title track was a 9-minute marching song for the displaced. Exodus, movement of Jah people. It wasn't just about Africa. It was about awakening, about rising from any system that enslaves. Natural Mystic opened the album like a whisper from another dimension. Slow, foreboding, a warning carried on the wind. There's a natural mystic blowing through the air. If you listen carefully, now you will hear. Songs like Guiltiness and the heathen delivered stern rebukes to Babylon, those complicit in injustice, whether through action or silence. Marley didn't scream. He channeled judgment through melody, and it hit harder than any sermon. But Side B was a revelation of another kind. It was joyous, tender, transcendent. In the midst of exile, Bob found a way to sing about love, sensuality, and spiritual union. Waiting in Vain was a plea wrapped in vulnerability. Turn Your Lights Down Low offered a moment of quiet intimacy. And then came the triumvirate of Jamming, Three Little Birds, and One Love. These were not just songs. They were prayers disguised as pop music, messages of healing that slipped through radio waves into homes, hearts, and governments. One Love in particular became an anthem, so simple, yet so profound. Bob wasn't naive. He wasn't preaching utopia. He knew the world was cruel. But he believed, with every fiber of his being, that unity was possible, that music could be the bridge. When Exodus was released in June 1977, it received modest attention, at first in Jamaica and the US. But in the UK and Europe, it exploded. The album stayed on the British charts for 56 consecutive weeks. Critics called it a masterpiece. Time magazine later named it the best album of the 20th century. But Bob didn't care for accolades. He cared that the message had spread. Still, there were shadows. During this time, Bob discovered a suspicious wound on his toe, sustained during a football match. At first, he ignored it. Healing, after all, was part of the Rastaway. But the wound worsened. Eventually, it was diagnosed as malignant melanoma, a rare and aggressive form of skin cancer. Doctors advised amputation. Bob refused. He believed the body was sacred and should not be dismembered. He chose less invasive treatment and kept moving forward, never publicly revealing the gravity of his condition. Even as his body began to betray him, Bob pressed harder, touring relentlessly, writing constantly, carrying a message heavier than flesh could hold. "My life is for people," he told a journalist, "not for myself. That is the way I am." By 1978, the world had changed. Reggae had become a global language. Rastafari was no longer ridiculed, it was respected. And Bob Marley? He was no longer just a Jamaican artist. He was a world icon, a musical prophet whose songs echoed from Kingston to Johannesburg, from Brixton to Brooklyn. But despite the danger, despite the exile, despite the pain, Bob never turned his back on Jamaica. He couldn't. It was his soil, his crucible, his heartbeat. And as fate would have it, he would soon return, not as a victim, but as a reconciler, standing between warring factions, asking them to see beyond the bullet, beyond the ballot, beyond the blood. But that story, the return to Kingston and the moment when Marley made history by uniting political enemies on stage, belongs to the next chapter. Because Exodus was not just an album. It was a prophecy fulfilled, a turning point, a declaration that no bullet, no border, no Babylonian scheme could ever silence the voice of Jah people. The revolution had found its rhythm, and the whole world was now dancing to it. Chapter 7, One Love, Two Worlds. Jamaica is a paradox wrapped in sunlight. Beneath the postcard palm trees and sugarcane fields lies a country haunted by its own heartbeat, a place of rhythm and rage, faith and fire. For Bob Marley, that contradiction had always been a source of inspiration and torment. He loved his homeland like a son loves a mother, fiercely, unconditionally, but with a broken heart. After his self-imposed exile in London, after the gunshots at 56 Hope Road, after Exodus turned him into a global prophet, Bob knew his journey was incomplete until he returned to the soil that made him. He knew that he could not sing of unity from across an ocean. He had to stand in the middle of the war and speak peace with his bare hands. And so, in 1978, Bob Marley came home, not as a refugee, but as a redeemer. The political landscape in Jamaica was no less violent than when he had left. In fact, it had worsened. The ideological tug of war between Michael Manley's People's National Party, PNP, and Edward Seaga's Jamaica Labour Party, JLP, had torn entire communities apart. Trenchtown, Bob's birthplace, was now a battlefield. Armed gangs, often backed by party money, patrolled neighborhoods. Political affiliation was no longer a matter of belief. It was a matter of life and death. Bob had always walked a delicate line. He didn't publicly endorse Manley or Seaga. To him, Babylon wore both colors, orange and green. But the people saw in Bob something that transcended partisanship. He was bigger than politics. He was a spiritual diplomat, a son of the ghetto who had risen not by bullets, but by truth in melody. Behind the scenes, efforts were underway to organize an event that might soothe the nation's open wounds. A concert, a symbol, something that could, even if for one night, remind Jamaica of its shared heartbeat. The plan became reality. The One Love Peace Concert, scheduled for April 22, 1978, at the National Stadium in Kingston. Bob agreed to headline, but not for showmanship. He saw it as a calling. In the days leading up to the event, Bob traveled into the deepest parts of Kingston, into communities devastated by gang warfare. He met with ghetto leaders, warlords, dons, men who lived by the gun and bled for political power. He didn't come with an entourage. He came alone, walking into danger with a smile and the words of a man who had nothing to prove but everything to give. He spoke to them not as a star, but as a brother. What you fighting for if your own youth still hungry? How Babylon give you gun but no food? What if we turn our war into words? Some laughed. Some listened. Some wept. The night of the concert arrived like prophecy fulfilled. Over 30,000 people packed the stadium. The air was electric with hope, tension, disbelief. A stage was built. Speakers towered like altars. Artists from across the island performed. But everyone waited for one man. And then, under floodlights and the breath of a restless nation, Bob Marley walked on stage, dreadlock swaying, guitar in hand, the echoes of positive vibration, rising like incense. But what happened next would become one of the most iconic moments in musical and political history. Midway through the performance, as the Wailers played Jammin', Bob called two unexpected guests to the stage, Michael Manley and Edward Sega, mortal enemies, leaders of rival factions, each responsible in some way for the blood that soaked Kingston streets. The crowd fell into a stunned silence. Bob turned to them and spoke, not with politics, but with reverence. "I just want to shake hands, show the people we're going to unite. We're going to unify." He took their hands, one in each of his, and raised them high above his head, holding them together in the air like a priest conducting a marriage. The crowd erupted in gasps, tears, thunder. It was not a performance. It was a miracle, a fleeting one, because after the music faded, the bullets returned. The war didn't end that night, but it paused, and that pause gave breath to a nation suffocating in its own division. Bob Marley had done what no politician could. He made the impossible visible, even if only for a moment. But unity on stage did not translate into peace in Bob's personal life. For all his spiritual strength and musical clarity, Bob was also a man of contradictions, a mystic in public, but deeply tangled in human desire behind closed doors. Though married to Rita Marley, Bob was not a monogamous man. He fathered at least 11 children with 7 different women, and rumors swirled of many more affairs. Some critics called him hypocritical. Others called him honest, living according to the natural laws of his Rasta beliefs, which saw women as queens and mothers of the earth, but did not impose Western marital norms. The truth, as always, was more complicated. Bob loved his children. He was present even in his absence. He wrote letters, sent for them, played football with them when he could. But he also carried guilt. Guilt for the pain caused. Guilt for the chaos left in the wake of his fame. Rita remained by his side through it all, more comrade than romantic partner. Their bond, forged in poverty and struggle, transcended traditional love. It was deeper, harder, sometimes colder, but unbreakable. Bob also struggled with trust. The more famous he became, the more vultures appeared. Managers, promoters, friends turned strangers. Money began flowing in, but so did lawsuits, theft, betrayal. Bob tried to hold on to his values, to give, to share, to lift his community. But the higher he rose, the harder it became to tell ally from leech. His spiritual life was equally complex. Though a devout Rasta, Bob read the Bible, the Quran, the Bhagavad Gita. He meditated, fasted, and reasoned for hours. But fame chipped at his solitude. He often retreated into silence, into long football matches that left him drenched in sweat and free of thought. "Me a man, not a god. Don't put me on no pedestal," he once told a reporter. But the world already had. In the months following the peace concert, Bob's health quietly declined. The cancer, now spreading, began to whisper in his bones. He kept it hidden. He told few. His shows continued. His albums grew bolder. But the man behind the music was increasingly exhausted, not from singing, but from carrying a world that refused to heal. He traveled. He meditated. he wrote songs with the urgency of someone racing against time. And yet he smiled, constantly, played with his children, reasoned with elders, smoked ganja, and laughed with friends. He didn't fear death, but he feared leaving his mission incomplete. One love, two worlds. That was the paradox Bob lived in. One love, a dream of unity, of equality, of shared humanity. The foundation of his music, his life, his very breath. Two worlds, the one he sang about and the one he lived in. One full of light, the other soaked in shadow. One where children danced to his records, the other where they died from bullets with political initials etched on their shells. He held both truths, in tension, in harmony, in song. And somehow, he made them dance together, even if just for one night, even if just in the echo of a chorus. One love, one heart. Let's get together and feel all right. Chapter 8, Survival and the Soldier's Heart. By the late 1970s, Bob Marley was no longer just a musician. He was a messenger with a global passport, a spiritual diplomat without a formal title, a barefoot prophet whose words carried weight in parliament halls and on dusty village streets alike. The transformation was complete. He had gone from rude boy to revolutionary, from singer to soldier. But it wasn't a war of bullets that Bob was fighting. It was a war of ideas, identity, and liberation. And the battlefield? The world itself. After the historic One Love Peace Concert in 1978, Bob didn't rest. He couldn't. He had stood between two political giants and raised their hands in the air like a priest of unity. But he knew better than most that symbolism was not salvation. The gunfire returned to Kingston. The divisions reopened like old wounds. That brief moment of national grace had passed, and Bob's heart was now pulled somewhere even deeper, toward Africa. Africa had always been more than a continent to Bob Marley. It was a spiritual homeland, the center of the Rastafari faith, the root from which his identity bloomed. But now, it became a focus of his mission. Africa, at that time, was rising and bleeding all at once. Countries were shaking off the chains of colonialism, but many were falling into new forms of dictatorship, poverty, and civil war. Bob saw these struggles as interconnected with Jamaica's own pain. To him, the oppression of black people anywhere was a thread that tied all their suffering together. He began writing with a different fire. Gone was the lover's croon, the softened spirituality. In its place stood a clarion call to arms, not of violence, but of consciousness. In 1979, Bob Marley and the Wailers released Survival, an album that was unlike any he had produced before. This was not just a collection of songs. It was a manifesto, a declaration of Pan-African solidarity, and a call for revolution, not only against governments, but against the mental chains left behind by slavery and colonialism. The album cover said it all. The flags of 48 African nations framed the border, surrounding the word survival in bold, defiant type. This wasn't reggae for the dance floor. This was reggae for the battlefield. From the very first track, So Much Trouble in the World, the tone was urgent, unflinching. Marley was no longer merely observing injustice. He was condemning it, invoking accountability, calling out corruption and greed, even at the highest levels. Ambush in the Night was not vague. It was a direct reflection of the assassination attempt on his life in 1976, a haunting confession cloaked in melody. Ambush in the night, all guns aiming at me. The lyrics carried the trauma, the betrayal, and the lesson that truth tellers in every era will be hunted. But perhaps the most important song on Survival was Africa Unite. It was a command, a dream, a promise. Africa Unite. Because we're moving right out of Babylon. In Bob's voice, it sounded less like music and more like a prophecy in progress. The album reached beyond the charts. It was adopted by students protesting apartheid in South Africa, by rebels in Zimbabwe, by thinkers in Ghana, by children in Jamaica who saw in Bob not just a musician, but a mirror of their own suffering turned sacred. Bob began traveling more frequently to the continent. His name carried weight in Africa, not because he was a pop star, but because he was a warrior with a message. In a time when most Western artists ignored African voices, Bob centered them. In interviews, he spoke of Kwame Nkrumah, Julius Nyerere, and Haile Selassie as heroes. He didn't merely speak to Africa, he spoke for it, and in doing so, gave global audiences a map of forgotten dignity. In 1980, the call came. The newly independent nation of Zimbabwe, formerly Rhodesia, invited Bob Marley to perform at their independence celebration on April 17, 1980. It was a moment soaked in history, the end of white minority rule, the birth of black sovereignty. Marley had funded part of the trip himself, bringing his entire band, instruments, and crew. He didn't ask for compensation. This was his moment, too. A moment of ancestral vindication. The stadium in Salisbury, now Harare, was filled with tens of thousands. As Bob took the stage, firecrackers exploded, some mistaken for gunfire. Soldiers panicked. The crowd surged. People were beaten. But Marley didn't stop. Even as chaos erupted around him, he sang Zimbabwe, the very song he had written before the country was even free. Every man got a right to decide his own destiny. That night, Marley didn't just perform. He baptized a nation. But back in Jamaica, and inside his own body, the war continued. The cancer, first diagnosed in 1977 after a football injury, led to the discovery of melanoma in his toe, had quietly metastasized. Bob told almost no one. He believed deeply in the sanctity of the body and the power of natural healing, in keeping with Rastafari Ital principles. He rejected amputation and turned instead to spiritual remedies, diet, and meditation. But by 1980, his health had begun to fail him in ways he couldn't ignore. During the Uprising tour, Bob collapsed while jogging in Central Park, New York. It was no longer just his toe. The cancer had spread to his brain, lungs, and liver. He was taken to Sloan Kettering Hospital. Tests confirmed the worst. He kept the diagnosis quiet. He performed one final show on September 23, 1980, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It was a performance soaked in sweat, glory, and sacred urgency. No one in the audience knew they were watching Bob Marley's final stage appearance. But some said his voice that night carried a strange kind of knowing, as if he were singing through the end of time. After the show, Bob sought treatment at controversial clinics in Germany, known for alternative methods. But nothing could stop what was already moving through him. And yet, even in pain, even with death creeping toward him, Bob remained committed to his people. He continued writing, meditating, recording fragments of songs that would later be polished by his children. He held his sons in his arms, blessed his daughters with quiet wisdom, and tried to prepare Rita for what was to come. "Don't cry, Rita," he whispered one night. "Ja don't leave his soldiers. Me just going to check in with him." In the end, Survival was more than an album. It was a blueprint, a declaration that the revolution was not in gunfire or politics, but in awakening, in remembering, in refusing to die quietly. Bob Marley, the soldier, knew his time was short, but he also knew that survival did not mean escaping death. It meant leaving behind enough truth to keep your people alive.